Hello, welcome to Music Weekly Extra with me, Rosie Swash. Earlier this week, I caught up with Jarvis Cocker to talk about his new album, Further Complications. I'm going to start by asking you to tell me about the Paris sort of visual arts experience you put on, because I wasn't, unfortunately, wasn't there to see it, and I've seen a bit of it online, but I'm not entirely sure what was behind it.
Right. I went to the gallery where we did it. It was called Gallery Chap. It's a small gallery, kind of, in Montmartre, the lower bit, not the bit where it is Waffles and Dali Museum. There was an exhibition of 15 artists did portraits of Amy Winehouse, including one which was Amy Winehouse represented as an airport, which was quite interesting. Anyway, I liked the layout of the gallery and I got on well with the owner of the gallery, and that kind of planted the seed in my mind to do it. Having been involved in music for a long time, I was thinking of whether you could present it in different ways, you know. And especially now, people are always saying, you know, oh, the music business is dead, you know, it's not a commercial enterprise anymore. I thought, well, if it's not a mass market kind of thing anymore, maybe the gallery system would be a better way of dispersing it. So I just decided to move into the gallery for a week and see what happened. I didn't really have hard and fast plans for it. We had a practical reason to be there, because I knew that we had to rehearse anyway, because we've got a tour coming up. So, but then I wanted to involve other people in it. So we had we would have hours where anybody could turn up with an instrument and play along, kind of improvisations and things. We invited people to come up with ideas for songs, like titles or moods and things like that. And then, like I say, we had the classes, which is another way of involving people. So non-musicians could join in, and also it made us make music in a different way, because, you know, like, say, for instance, when the belly dancer came in, we asked her, what, you know, we didn't know what kind of rhythm we should play, really, so she kind of talked us through it, and then she said she wanted lots of tempo changes, you know, going from fast to slow and stuff like that, so we tried to do something that was kind of tailored to what she was doing, so that was quite a good laugh. Plus, you got to look at a woman belly dancing for half an hour as well. You know.
Would you regard it as a success?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always coming up with these kind of crackpot schemes, and people say, oh, you know, what are you playing at? And I'm lucky to be on Rough Trade, because they kind of indulge my whims more than other record labels would, I think. I didn't want to overplay it, because the thing was, I didn't know how it was going to work, so I wanted it to hopefully take on a life of its own. It's in quite a quiet, semi-residential area of the gallery. It's not on a main street or anything. And so my ideal kind of thing would be, like, if somebody was walking the dog and then they heard some kind of interesting noise and then they wandered in and got involved, you know. I wanted it to be like that, rather than a zazow, here's a big media event kind of thing. And I was really pleased with the way it went. You know, it built up, and on the last day when we played a concert, there was about 600 people there, you know, whereas on the first day, the Tuesday, was like about 5 people there. So kind of word of mouth spread it around, and I suppose the internet helped to spread the word as well. So for me, it was a real success, yeah. We were webcasting it as well, which I'm going to kind of produce highlights of. It might take me a while, because I've got like 36 hours of film to go through to sort out stuff, but I'll go through the stuff, and I'm sure that there's some quite interesting music that was done during that time, you know.
You mentioned earlier being out of music for a while, and as far as I could tell when I was following the arrival of your new album, which is called Further Complications, it seems that until sort of right at the last minute, you weren't sure of the track listing and you weren't sure what songs you wanted to go on there, and I wondered whether Further Complications was also a late title in referring to the...
No, I knew that the album was going to be called that, and all the kind of late thing was, again, due to my unreasonableness. Like, we only started recording this record in January, as you may know. Well, generally speaking, you know, records get recorded and then they don't come out for maybe a year or something. Mm. I just wanted to get this out, because I wanted to play this summer. I need the exercise. I just wanted to get out and play. It was 2.5 years since my last record, so we had to kind of rush it through. So basically, we had to kind of send a sampler out with the tracks that were finished whilst we were still finishing off the other bits. And we'd recorded 15 songs, and I didn't know which ones were going to turn out good and which ones were going to turn out not so good. So I couldn't really finalise it all till the last minute. But that kind of fits with the title, doesn't it, really? Further Complications. Not a tongue-in-cheek, but it's a slightly light-hearted title. To me, it's an equivalent to Shit Happens. It's like, you know what I mean? It's
just a shelf-friendly version.
You know what I mean? It's like as you go on, things get more complicated, but, you know, so what? Deal with it.
I think my favourite song on the album for the minute is Slush, which has a real sort of melancholy thread to it. And initially, I just thought it was a love song because it's got lines like, my heart melted at your touch. But then I read that it was related to or inspired by your trip to the Arctic, which was sort of a musician's mission.
I wrote the musical part of it on the boat when we went with these people from Cape Farewell. It's a thing that was set up about 6 or 7 years ago. They take creative people up to the Arctic regions. I think the first one had Ian McEwan and people on it. And last year's was the largest one so far, and I was lucky enough to go on it. And, you know, the idea is that you're inspired in some way by the experience, and that also in some way draws attention to the issue of climate change. I mean, so Slush seemed... I kind of got that title quickly because that's kind of what I expected to see when I got to the North Pole, because I'd heard so much about global warming. I thought there wouldn't be any ice left. It would just be slush, like that horrible, dirty city snow. But then I did go a bit slushy when I was up there. I had a moment on the deck of the boat when I was on my own and we were going through this kind of fjord, and it was so beautiful. It did give you that feeling of insignificance. It didn't seem to be negative to me. It just kind of made you feel a bit humble and lucky to be a part of it all. But also realise that, I don't know, mankind's a small part of nature, so they shouldn't kind of bully the rest of nature. Do you know what I mean? They shouldn't throw the weight around too much. But of course they always do. So that song kind of came out of that, and I'm not a very complex character, really. The thing that slush can mean two things, you know, it can be the actual physical, dirty, slushy, horrible city snow, or you can have a slushy ballad, you know, that kind of sentimental thing.
I did detect a theme of perhaps the first flushes of love on this album in songs like You're In My Eyes. How reflective of what was happening at the time of you writing it?
I don't know about that. I think there wasn't... The last record probably dealt more with wider things. You know, you had Cunts Still Running the World, Auschwitz to Ipswich, Fat Children. For whatever reason, I kind of seemed to tackle subjects more. This time, it just moved closer to home, I suppose. And when you move closer to home, you deal with emotional things. So I think... Yeah, this record deals more in emotions than the last one, I think, yeah.
You also, I guess with Angela, I'm thinking of, which is the lead single, writing from a female point of view, which you've always done so brilliantly, right back to the beginning from songs like Lip Gloss and She's a Lady on His and Hers up until now. Why do you feel so comfortable writing from that point of view, or I guess fascinated, or writing about these women, these very strong characters?
Well, I like strong women. I don't like wishy-washy women. You know, I like to be bossed around, basically. I do.
I believe you. Yeah. But why? Why do you think that is?
I would have to go and talk to a psychiatrist and spend a lot of money to find that out. I'm sure it would go back to my parents and the way that I was brought up.
You also you allow yourself to take on the role as the shoulder to cry on, which comes up a bit on Leftovers on this album. Is that still based on, I guess, adolescent experiences, or is it a sort of fantasy role you see yourself in as the hero?
Well, I think, you know, I was brought up in a very female-dominated environment, so I'm used to thinking of women as my friends. And then when you get to adolescence and you start fancying women, that's when you get a kind of weird, because to feel desire towards a woman is different to being friends to her, with her. And it's the crux of it, really. But I'm not so nice. I'm not such a great shoulder to cry on, I wouldn't imagine. I probably just want my evil way.
You're still on good terms with Pulp and still playing with them in various band members here and there. Would you ever see the band coming out of hiatus? Like, I guess, just about every other band on the planet at the moment who seems to be performing.
Well, everybody's done it, haven't they? I mean, it seems a bit boring. would pulp ever be, could they ever be raised from their death-like coma? I don't know. Like you say, I get on with the people in the band fine, and so there's no barrier to it that way, but it just doesn't seem like there's any point at the moment. But as I've said in other interviews, I would like to catch one of those Blur shows this summer. You know, their heyday was at the same kind of time as Pulse, I suppose. We were part of the same scene, so it'd be kind of interesting to see how that pans out.
Because it's weird that, for me, that you are considered part of the same scene, because I find their music so
different. Oh, yeah, we were older. I mean, but, yeah, we were quite close at one point, because, like, they took us on an American tour in, like, 1994 or something. I think it was when they were having a big thing with girls and boys, you know. And so, yeah, we hung around quite a lot at one point, and then we kind of fell out for a bit, and then I bumped into Damon again. We were both doing this Scott Walker thing at the Barbican just before Christmas last year. It was nice, we kind of made it up, and nice to see him.
You've made some remarks in the past about, well, I'm thinking more about Freaks, which obviously is quite a long time ago and is the band's first album, which you sort of express a bit of embarrassment about it. And I wondered if you feel that way about playing Pulp's music again, or you still feel like you are connected to it and it is a...
No, I'd say it's the opposite, really. The obvious thing when I started and embarked on my solo career, which I still find out, I can't say that with a smile, but would have been to slip a couple of crowd-pleasing Pulp numbers in. But the reason I don't play them is not because I hate them. It's because it's the opposite, really. That I don't listen to my own music much, but when I hear them on the radio, I think they stand up quite well. But a lot of how those songs sounded was to do with the fact that it was a group that all kind of grown up together and learned how to play together, and so we weren't great musicians by any stretch of the imagination, but we had a certain sound because we'd all done it together, and I just don't think the songs would sound right played by this band. If people have fond memories of those songs, which I'm very flattered that they have, I don't want to kind of mess them up by playing some horrible version of it, you know. So I'd rather just leave it as a pleasant memory for people.
Do you ever see yourself, you know, wandering away from music completely? Because you've done various, you know, art-related things for TV, like Journeys into the Outside. But would you ever see yourself doing something completely different and never making another album?
We'll see what happens to this one once it comes out. I don't know. I don't think so. I had that moment when I first moved to France, I suppose. That would have been the point to pack it in, and I almost did jack it in, but I kind of discovered, it'll sound very corny, I discovered that I couldn't live without it. But it's true. It's the one thing that I kind of feel drawn to doing, and so I'd be stupid to stop myself doing it. So, although sometimes I'm horrified that I'm still doing it at 45, and maybe I should have grown old gracefully and retired and whatever. It's what I do, and so I just have to face it. I get pleasure from it, and I hope to give some pleasure to other people as well. And I do those other things, and I'm really lucky to be asked to do other things, and things like editing the Today programme, and I've been asked to present TV stuff and all that kind of thing. That's really good, because I think the one thing about being in a band is if you just think about the band all the time, you can get stale. And so it's really good to have these other things which take me into other areas and just kind of keep my brain alive, you know, which at my age, love, you need it, you know what I mean? Use it or lose it, that's what they say, isn't it?
You've lived in London and you've lived in Paris more than once, although that's where you are now. Do you ever see yourself returning to Sheffield?
I spent quite a lot of time in Sheffield earlier this year, because my grandmother died, and all during that process I went back quite a lot. And I still enjoy being there. I've thought about it sometimes. Usually I think about it when I have to go to an airport or something. It sounds a bit stupid, but because the countryside around Sheffield is so beautiful, I've also got a friend who's got a house on the outskirts, and you're basically living out in the countryside, but then you can get back into the city in like 10 minutes. So that tempts me a bit, that you can kind of have the best of both worlds. I think if I lived in, you know, the depths of Cornwall, I'd probably commit suicide after about a month because of the isolation or something. But that kind of living in the countryside where you knew you could be, you know, in a cafe in the centre of town if you wanted to in 10 minutes, maybe I could handle that.
I wanted to just ask about Steve Albini, who produced this album. Why did you want him to do it?
It came about just through circumstances, really. We were playing a festival in Chicago. Steve Mackey, the bass player, and Ross Orton, the drummer. They also produce stuff. They work as a duo called the Cavemen, and they produce other bands and stuff like that. And they really rate Steve Albini, especially Ross, I guess Ross is a drummer and he's famed for his drum sounds, so I'm told. I'm not a very technical person, so I don't know about these things. But anyway, we were going to Chicago, and they said, Steve Albini's got a studio there, why don't we do a couple of days recording? And I said, yeah, okay. And then the pound was really strong at the time. So it was something ridiculous, like about £400 a day with him thrown in. So that was a bargain. So I thought, why not? Also, rather than just go all that way and play one concert, it seemed more kind of ecologically sound to go and stay for a couple of weeks and get a bit more work done. So we went and did it. I enjoyed the process. And then it was just a coincidence, because I'd approached writing this album by involving the band a lot more in it. The last record was done very much me sat on my own, writing songs, finishing them, then getting the band to play them. This time, to speed it up and also to make it more fun, I'd involve the band from the outset. So the songs had been written that way, and we'd played them live, and so I knew that I kind of wanted to capture some of that in the recording process. And the thing is that Steve Albini, that's the way his studio is set up to do things, because he's got this thing that he wants to capture the sound of how a band is. So it was just fortuitous that it was a good fit. Some of the reviews I've seen kind of, not particularly irritate me, but make me smile in a way, because they make a big thing about the fact that, oh yes, Steve Albini's fingerprints are all over the record, which is kind of strange, because the way that he records things is that he aspires to record them as naturally as possible. I suppose he would contend that on a normal record, the producer's fingerprints are all over it, because they've tarted it up. But I guess, as a culture, we've got used to listening to that kind of slightly adulterated form of music. But this is a debate that could go on forever and ever. But I really enjoyed working with him. It was really nice to work with someone who did have that attitude, that really it was all, the band had to make all the decisions, and he was just there to do a job, which was to record you. You know, even down to he wears overalls to go to work.
And you mentioned there about involving the band more in the writing. I did feel like there was maybe some sort of glam era influence on this album.
Well, they're very glamorous guys. It kind of went back a bit further than that. It's got fuzzy guitars, but like Tim, the guitarist, is very much into that kind of 60s garage rock type of stuff. I happened to buy this kind of old guitar when we were in Los Angeles, which had a very kind of crude, fuzzy sound, and I got into doing that. So yeah, it's riffs, I suppose, which glam rock was based around as well. I just kind of enjoyed it, and I thought I wasn't going to try and think it through too much. I was just going to kind of follow my instincts of what I enjoyed, you know. You know, the record was recorded quite quickly as well. It only took about 2.5 weeks, and I kind of wanted to get things done before I had time to overthink it and talk myself out of something.